Wake up! Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. You are now listening to You and Me at 30. I'm your host, Dr. Joshua K. Wright. I realize that you could be anywhere in the world right now, but you're here listening to me, and I sincerely appreciate that. You and Me at 30 is a new talk show airing on Sunday mornings. I'll be bringing you lively, thought-provoking discussion on a variety of topics. This show will feature an extended conversation with a guest. While many of these individuals will come from the University of Maryland Eastern Shore and the local community, I will also feature several guests from around the country. Please note that the views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of 91.3 WESM or the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. Over the past several years, the UMES School of Pharmacy has made significant progress in achieving its mission. The school has been deliberate about providing patient-centered care, engaging the community to address various health issues, and creating an environment that fosters discovery and research. The school's faculty has had 6 patents approved, and the school has launched a graduate program in pharmaceutical sciences offering Master of Science degree, the Doctor of Pharmacy, and the Doctor of Philosophy degree. My guests today are School of Pharmacy faculty members Dr. Sean Vasaitis and Dr. Patrice Jackson Ayotunde. Dr. Vasaitis is an associate professor of pharmaceutical science and the pharmacy school's interim assistant dean for student affairs. Dr. Jackson Ayotunde is an associate professor of medicinal chemistry. I'm also joined by Isis Amaye, a fourth-year doctoral candidate in the Department of Pharmaceutical Sciences, and Dr. Tawes Harper, who was a 2013 graduate from the School of Pharmacy. Thank you all so much for joining me this morning.
Pleasure to be here, and thank you for this opportunity for us to share a little bit about what's been going on over in the School of Pharmacy.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us here.
In addition to the other honors that I mentioned in my introduction, UMES has had Maryland's highest first rate pass on the pharmacy board exam. What's the secret to the school's success?
I would say that it's due to a few different factors. One, the people involved. You have an excellent leadership team, excellent faculty, the staff, of course, the students are wonderful, very intelligent students that we've been able to bring in. The faculty is diverse, they're caring and supportive. The school administration overall, the president, the provost, everyone has been very supportive in helping to get the school running and to keep us on track as well. And in addition to the people, there's also the process. So we do have a modular system where the students can focus on one area at a time as they go through the program. The curriculum is very dynamic. We try to use best teaching practices. So we're very careful in the way we teach, the way we assess. The success of the students is the success of the program. So we're always thinking about what we can do to help them to learn and be successful. And then we also have a global perspective. So we like to be up to date with the things that are happening and to make a difference in the community and the world.
Dr. Harper, what attracted you to UMES School of Pharmacy?
Well, after I graduated from high school, I attended college over at the University of Maryland College Park. I originally grew up in Dorchester County in Cambridge. And to be quite honest, as far as postgraduate programs, like a Doctor of Pharmacy degree, it just wasn't available in, you know, the area that I grew up in. But around the time that I was starting to look into what I wanted to do with my professional life, I got noticed that there was going to be a program opening up at UMES in Princess Anne. And I just wanted to really, part of it was I wanted to come back home to be in my general area on the shore. But another part of it was I wanted to be a part of building something, and I would be a part of the first class. I would be enrolling in a program that would really focus on addressing the issues and building professionals with the intention of keeping them in the actual area, whether it be Worcester County, Wicomico County, all the way up, and even taking into account parts of the Eastern Shore and Delaware and Virginia. So that was one of the main focuses of why I ultimately decided to pursue the program at UMES right when it was really in infancy, is first starting.
Right, and I know it's always hard being the first, being a trailblazer. What do you remember about that initial class in terms of how many students were actually involved in the program with you when you started out?
Oh boy, a history lesson. So I do like the trailblazer term, but if I recall, we originally started with about 62 or 65 students, and then our final graduating class, I believe, was 57. But yeah, it was interesting because we, for 2 years when we were doing our schoolwork, we were all together. We were together essentially every day of the week except every other Tuesday, and we were going out on rotations, at least in our first year. So you really had to build relationships with people, and you got to know a lot of people. You know, one of the jokes I made upon at our graduation and hooding ceremony was I never anticipated going to as many baby showers as I attended during my 3 years at UMES. And it's also quite interesting because I'm actually on the way to a wedding in San Diego of one of my classmates. So, you know, you can kind of still build those relationships even many years after you leave.
And what have you been doing from a professional standpoint since graduating?
So, right after I graduated, I did a one-year residency within the VA system of Lebanon in Pennsylvania. And then for 8 to 9 months, I worked as a consultant in the state of Delaware. And then after that, I took a position as a clinical pharmacist specialist working at the University of Maryland Shore Regional Health, which has 3 inpatient facilities and 4 emergency departments within the Eastern Shore, within Talbot, Dorchester, Queen Anne, Chick counties.
Isa, same question. What attracted you to the program here at UMES?
I was part of the first cohort for the pharmaceutical sciences research graduate program. So I guess you could say I was closer to home because I got my bachelor's degree in biology in UMES in 2013. And when the program started, I did some research, read up on the program, read up on the faculty, of course, since I will be working closely with them. And I found some excellent information about the pharmaceutical sciences faculty and the research that was being done there. They were, you could say, groundbreaking research. I decided to reach out to the director of the program and got more information. And I applied for the program with funding, and I got accepted into the program in the summer of 2015, and we started, and it's been amazing. It's been an amazing run so far. So to say what attracted me to the program, it was the first was availability. It was just there, and since I was already in UMES.
And Isis, if you don't mind, you were rewarded for your research this past December. Tell the audience a little bit about your research and also talk about some of the collaborative work that you've been doing with faculty from the school, such as Dr. Jackson Ayutunde.
So Dr. Jackson Ayutunde is my direct mentor, my supervisor and advisor. She's like all in one to me. So our research is focused on developing potential drugs for drug-resistant epilepsy. And prior to joining Dr. Jackson Ayutunde's lab, I haven't had or done as much extensive reading on epilepsy and subsequently drug-resistant epilepsy. But after meeting with her, I think about the second week of my being in the program, she discussed what her research entailed, and I did some more literature research on my own to see the statistics and the burden on the community for epilepsy, which if you were to take some time to do some research, you will find that it is actually very cumbersome because about 65 million people in the world are suffering from this disease. Prior to joining the lab, I didn't know or have that information. So I joined the lab and she was very welcoming. She told me everything that needs to be done, everything that has been done, and how I could contribute to our research. And I focused on it. I worked hard on it, brought my opinions to the research group, and we worked together. So I've had the opportunity to present my research in different symposiums and national meetings. The one you mentioned was the American Association of Pharmaceutical Scientists National Meeting last year that was held in Washington, D.C. I presented a part of my research and as an abstract, and our abstract was selected as one of the best abstracts due to the work that we were doing, since it was contributing to the knowledge of epilepsy and the potential treatment options, and it was a very big acknowledgement for our lab.
Dr. Jackson Ayotunde, you've worked a lot with your students. Isis just talked about some of the work that you guys have been doing, and then you'd worked with Dr. Harper in the past as well on a patent for a potential drug to treat epilepsy. Why, first of all, tell me, why is it important for you to include students in your research?
Yes, yeah, so the students are, I look at them as the driving force behind the research. Without the students being in the lab, things would just not continue to move forward. With Isis being the graduate student that she is, fourth year PhD candidate, she's definitely in the lab daily, conducting the research, again, moving things forward. When I worked with Dr. Taz Hopper back in 2011, when he was a rising SP2 student, he was the one to really help build the lab, start the research, so that we kind of worked side by side with other students as well. But Dr. Harper worked with me in the lab. He came back his second year. He came back in his third year. So he continued his research for the full 3 years that he was doing his pharmacy doctorate degree.
Dr. Harper, how beneficial was that for you, being able to work so closely with Dr. Jackson Ayotunde?
I mean, it certainly kept me on my toes. She's very, very professional, and she also has a very narrow focus when it comes to her research. And, I mean, where it's at today certainly would not be there without her being the driving force. I mean, it's nice that she'll say that the students have a role as a driving force, but certainly, I mean, we took our lead from our leader, essentially. It was a nice change of pace, because when you're in school, all you really think about are exams and passing exams and then taking breaks from exams. So it was certainly nice, again, to have that nice change of pace and to be in the lab. I had some experience working in an analytical chemistry lab, so it was a little bit of a change, at least from a discipline standpoint, but I certainly found all of my time there, whether it was the summer of 2011 all the way up right before I took my board exam in 2013, whenever I could find the free time to help and pitch in, you know, the 1 or 2% that I could contribute to the process. And that's what I'll say about that.
Okay. And Dr. Jackson Ayotunde, so you and Dr. Harper, you all were rewarded a U.S. patent, right? What's the process for obtaining a patent? How hard or how easy is it to do that?
Well, it's definitely not an easy process. It was a total of 4 years and 6 months from the initial provisional patent application until we were awarded April 13th, 2018. So it was a really long process. The first process is to apply for the provisional patent. That gives you a year of protection, and it gives the U.S. Patent Office to research other art that is similar. That's the term that they use, other art that's similar. Make sure that there's nothing out there that's an addition or the same in terms of what you're trying to protect. And so then when that year is complete, within that year, you need to apply for a non-provisional patent, and that will start the process of application for a full patent, full protection. And so we filed the provisional October 21st, 2013. the non-provisional patent was filed October 21st, 2014. And so throughout that time, you work with lawyers. I work with University of Maryland College Park, Office of Technology Commercialization, throughout the patent process. And so at some point with the lawyers, they do a lot of the communication. And so with the patent office, the U.S. patent office, and there was a lot of rebuttal back and forth over some things that took a while. But once that span was over, we were awarded. Me as inventor, Dr. Harper as co-inventor, that was a very exciting moment and a relief that everything was approved and accepted by the U.S. Patent Office.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to UMES 30. Today's guests are faculty, students, and alumni from the School of Pharmacy at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. So prostate cancer is the nation's second leading cause of cancer death in men, with a 1 in 9 lifetime risk of being diagnosed with the disease. For African-American men, the risk of dying from low-grade prostate cancer is double that of men of other races. Dr. Vasaitis, you have received patents for your research in terms of cancer. Please give a brief overview of what you've been doing.
Prostate cancer, it's an umbrella term. So there are different ways that the cancer can be driven to grow under that term. So like you have, if you think about automobiles, you have Nissans, you have Fords, you have, you know, Chevrolet or whatever. So when you think of cancer, that's also an umbrella term. So when it comes to prostate cancer, the cancer can be fueled in different ways. The majority of the prostate cancers are going to be fueled at some point by androgens. Androgens are hormones that the body makes naturally, and they're responsible for things like male secondary sexual characteristics, the deep voice, right, muscles, things like that.
Okay.
All right, so the research that we've been doing, and this is in collaboration with researchers at University of Maryland, Baltimore, so Dr. Vincent Injar, who's my mentor, and formerly Dr. Brody, who passed away fairly recently. Yeah, so the way that we've been looking at this, we've been trying to find ways to disrupt androgen signaling. So you're taking away the source that makes the cancers grow. So this would go through different ways. What usually happens in the body, the androgen binds with a receptor. So you can think of it kind of like a lock and a key. So if the androgen is the key, when it binds with the lock being the receptor, it turns it on, it opens it, and then things happen downstream, the cancer grows. So we've been looking at different ways to break up that signaling. So one is to get rid of the androgens themselves, so reducing the synthesis of the androgens. The second one is to block the androgens from binding with the receptors. And then the third way was to destroy the receptors themselves. And what we've been able to do is to have compounds that are able to do all of those things, have single agents that can act in multiple ways.
Why are the statistics so high when you talk about black men dying of prostate cancer? I know at my church, we do. I go to a majority African-American church in Prince George's County, Maryland, and, you know, we'll do an annual health fair, and they always tell the men especially, you know, you guys need to get your prostate checked. You need to get your checkup for prostate. Why is this such a big, you know, issue, particularly in the black community?
All right, so there are a number of different factors. I mean, the answer isn't completely known, so okay, put that out there right away. But some of the ideas we have, I mean, one, there's a social aspect. So there could be factors related to insurance. So African-American males may not be covered as well as you might see in the majority population. There are also some genetic factors as well. So it could depend on different expression of genes and the proteins that are going to be there that might help to drive the cancer. And also it could be where the cancer is located. So if the biopsy is taken from a certain area, you might get low-grade cancer in the biopsy specimen, but what actually might be going on, you may have some other cells that are abnormal in a different location. And some of the research suggested that some of the locations where African Americans may have the cancer growth, it's not as easily accessible. So where you might have high grade tumors, which will be a poor prognosis.
Huh, interesting. Do you think that we'll ever see a day where cancer is cured, where we no longer have this disease that's killing so many people in our society?
I think that you'll find different cancers are cured. Again, it's kind of an umbrella term. Mm-hmm. So, you know, breast cancer, it's fueled a different way than prostate cancer, and same with lung cancer. It's all a little bit different. So, I mean, I'm hopeful. And, you know, we're always finding new and exciting discoveries, and you know, everyone we're hoping is going to be the big one, the next one, and the one that's going to, you know, really knock out cancer in general. So as we continue to elucidate different pathways, maybe we will find some more common areas that will be useful in treating, you know, a variety of different cancers, and will be more successful. But I like the way things are going, at least, and that we have been able to find some promising avenues of research.
In terms of the prostate cancer, what should men do in order to make sure they're healthy, in terms of like when should they start getting checkups and things of that nature?
All right, so there are some differences of opinion in that especially when you look back at African Americans versus Caucasians. So some of the literature, again, is suggesting that African Americans may do better by continuing to get screening earlier, whereas there's been some, we're not as aggressive with the screening as we were prior to 2012 in general, and it might be better for African Americans to go back and maybe have a little bit more screening because of the higher incidence of death and also the advanced stage prostate cancer that is found when we do find prostate cancer in African Americans.
So we often hear in the media about the low numbers of minorities that are involved in STEM careers. And anybody can answer this question. What's the solution to that problem? And how have you all managed to be so successful within STEM?
The solution to that problem, that's huge. I think that nationally, there's a lot of different entities that's looking at to answer that question. But some of the things that I have been involved in and others can be involved in is really introducing the youth, elementary school students, even starting at that young, or middle school students, to STEM and how wonderful the STEM disciplines are. I am a member of the Princess Anne chapter of the Lynx Incorporated, and we actually participated in an event where we had a program called STEM Stars, and we introduced that to the young ladies at Washington High School in Princess Anne in Somerset County. I know that we also have an AAPS student chapter in the Pharmaceutical Science Department that ISIS is currently chair of. And they will one day go out to the local elementary schools, high schools, to talk about the discipline of drug discovery and development, pharmaceutical sciences, and introduce that to students.
And I would also say that, you know, UMES is part of the solution. Mm-hmm. So this is a great place where we do encourage minorities, and it obviously is an HBCU.
Right.
It's part
right.
of our mission. Yeah. And also following up with Dr. Jackson Iatunde, the mentorship is very, very important. Right. And this is a place where we do provide that kind of mentorship for students.
Right. Isis, tell our listeners why, if they're thinking about a career within pharmaceutical science, that they should consider attending UMES.
Well, to start with, our classes are really not the physical class, but we have a small entering class every other year. Sometimes we make exceptions, but I'm mentioning that because due to the size of the entry class, you have a very good student-faculty ratio. So you have the opportunity of working with any faculty of your choice. Like, you have this endless possibilities of what kind of research you want to be involved in. We're doing extensive drug development research at every level of the drug development process. You talk about the medicinal chemistry portion, the pharmacology portion, the drug delivery portion. So there is different opportunities for you to be involved in, to contribute to the community, to let yourself know that you're actually doing research that is that's contributing to the society, and not just something that over the years you just toss your dissertation somewhere, that or your thesis somewhere, that oh, it was just something along the way. So for students that are thinking about getting a pharmaceutical science career, my advice to them would be to seriously consider UMES, at the UMES School of Pharmacy, because you have the opportunity to let your opinions be heard. The faculty, they are great listeners. They are open to whatever ideas you are, and they are ready to help you bring those ideas, those creative ideas, to reality. So that would be my advice to them.
And Dr. Harper, you want to add any final thoughts on that?
I think as an alumnus of the program, it's been 6 years now since I graduated. It has been interesting from the prospect of being a student and seeing how things work into then, you know, being a professional and seeing how things work and develop. And I would say that at UMES, they are within the School of Pharmacy, there is not a sense of, well, we need to continue doing things the same way they've always been done because that's the way we've been doing them. Luckily enough, the program is so fresh and so new that you can get people in that will have different ideas and you can incorporate them, and no one has a set mindset of, like I just mentioned, we've always done it this way, we're going to continue doing it this way. That's just not how it is at the School of Pharmacy, and that is one of the good things to see, that people are open to new ideas and changing, especially when there is a need to change.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time, but I want to thank everybody for joining me this morning, and just continue to keep up all the good work that you all are doing.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Yep, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We end each show with a segment called Parting Shots. Here I give my thoughts on something happening in the news, pop culture, life in general that's piqued my interest. UMES will hold its annual spring commencement ceremony on Friday, May 24th. This year's commencement speaker is Dr. John B. King Jr. Dr. King is the president and chief executive of the Education Trust, a national nonprofit that seeks to close the achievement gaps for students from preschool through college. He served in President Barack Obama's cabinet as the 10th U.S. Secretary of Education. Dr. King is also the youngest grandchild of one of this university's original graduates. His paternal grandmother, Estelle Stansberry, graduated from the school in 1894 when it was then known as Princess Anne Academy. Mrs. Stansberry went on to become a nurse at a hospital in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Once again, Dr. King will be speaking here at UMES on May 24th. Hearty congratulations to all of this year's graduates. And that's our show for the week. Thanks again to all of our guests. We do this every Sunday at 10:30 a.m. If you like the show, please tell your friends about it. Like us on Facebook and other forms of social media. A special shout out, as always, to Uncle Phil and Aunt Viv. Have a blessed day.